hand out apartments or rooms, but also to have some kind of agreement where they are part of the deal and also included with some obligation.
You know, Walter, this is nobody back in Cleveland. One thing I don't want to completely pass by that you said, which the more you explained it, the less I understood it. You were talking about the business community understands it's bad for tourism, it's bad for business if there's a lot of homelessness. Well, we've got a business community here in the United States. And I am not aware of any real organized effort. Maybe I'm sure there is somewhere, but I'm not seeing an organized effort on the part of the business community to solve this problem. The business community's attitude in the United States is push the people out of sight and to heck with them. That's basically what goes on in city after city. They say, oh, you're bad for business because you're in front of it. You're unsightly, so they get the police to put the people someplace else in town. That's about the extent of it. Why is the business community in Switzerland motivated to solve things when the business community here is really only motivated
pushing people around?
Yeah.
Well, I hope my explanations do not make more confusion and enlighten things. But first of all, the business community addresses itself to the politicians and asks from the politicians to solve the problem. So it's not themselves doing some programs, but they are doing some pressure on the city council, on the city parliament, to solve the problem. And the links are quite direct between the community, the business, and the politicians. But the other answer is also Switzerland may be a little bit too small. You know, our cities are not that size that you could push out people in another part of the city and you wouldn't see them anymore. And the country is not so big that you could just push them out of your state and you won't see them anymore. So because of the sheer size also, you have to give some solution. You can just not push the people around. Sometimes there have been also attempts, you know, those to bring them away from one square and to put them to another, but it's not a very successful story because, as I said, it's all in a few miles distance, and if they show up here, then they are pushed away from one place, they will show up in another place. So this is probably one of the reasons, the small size of cities and the country, which needs then to go for a real solution and not just pushing people around.
Stephen or Michael, I'm curious, what is the role of the business community in Canada on this issue?
Well, it's just Michael in Toronto, and it's very interesting because I'll tell you a personal story because about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I spent a lot of time monitoring all the media, and I noticed that the chief executive officer of one of the largest chartered banks in Canada called the Toronto Dominion Bank was giving these speeches at these clubs, service clubs and so on, and he was talking about homelessness and saying it's a serious problem and the government should get involved in solving it. And the first few times I read his speeches, I thought, boy, his speechwriter is going to get fired because, you know, that's not what the business people usually say. Usually what they say is, you know, these are all bums and they need to be motivated and, you know, we got to cut taxes and, you know, pay attention to the fundamentals and all the usual mantra. Said that enough times that I actually then wrote on behalf of the National Housing and Homelessness Network to the chief executive officer of this bank and said, we should meet because obviously you and I have a common agenda here. And sure enough, about a month later, we sat down in this boardroom with a bunch of executives from the bank. And over the course of a year, we talked about what a bank could do, a national chartered bank, you know, one of the biggest banks in Canada, around this issue. And one of the things we decided was that their economics department could issue a report, which wouldn't be much different. My paid work is I work as a research associate at the University of Toronto at a small urban research institute called the Center for Urban and Community Studies. We're constantly putting out research. Most of the time it gets dismissed as kind of left-leaning academic gibberish and that sort of stuff. But TD Bank issues their report, comes out in the summertime. It says that that one in five Canadian households are suffering under the affordable housing crisis. It's one of the most important public policy issues in facing the country. Gets huge attention across the country because a bank is saying it and not some, you know, academics or left-wing social advocates, that sort of thing. We found that it was very interesting. We kept asking ourselves, why does the bank really care? You know, are they looking for some money here? And obviously, there's not much money to be made in this area because, of course, homeless people don't have money. And in the end, what we decided was that, in fact, a lot of these business guys were stepping over the bodies of homeless people as they're going to and from their bank towers. And after a while, some of them began to say, well, maybe we should think a bit about this and do something about it. So I hate to be sort of really soft and sound like I'm being a Pollyanna here, but in fact, we've found in a number of communities that the local business people have begun to you know, really see that social issues are as important as the kinds of things they're normally concerned about, taxation, the economy, all that sort of thing. And we've been able to engage them in very practical ways. And one of the things that we've done in Toronto is we've taken the presidents of banks and senior executives, members of their board of directors, we've taken them out at nighttime to go and visit homeless people sleeping under the bridges. And, of course, we make all these arrangements in advance so that nobody's inconvenienced, none of the homeless people. But we want them to get a firsthand feeling of what's really going on out there. And it's quite amazing what happens when these you know, business people who deal with stereotypes about who the homeless are,
Michael,
they actually meet homeless people and they hear their stories and they find out, you know, one day we were out and we ran across this woman who was on a grate in front of the hospital. She'd been a nurse at the hospital, had been laid off about 2 years earlier as part of cutbacks by the government in funding, lost her job, ended up being homeless, and here she was, from having worked inside the hospital to sleeping on a grate out in front of the hospital. And that was a very compelling story, and that turned a number of heads. So we've found a lot of the one-on-one stuff working with these business guys has been very helpful. But then what we immediately say to them is, you guys need to use your voice and influence. And Walter said this, you know, as well, that you know, that oftentimes politicians pay more attention to business people than they do to social advocates. So we've been using them to convince the government to get reengaged in some of these issues.
Well, I must say I'm very glad to hear that, Michael. I mean, I think that is a flaw on the left, that we tend sometimes to treat wealthy and powerful people as their roles and not as human beings who are occupying those roles. And I think that's a very good thing if you're able to reach out to them as human beings.
Well, you know, and it's something that, you know, we do in a lot of ways. And I don't want to suggest by any means that you know that there's a consensus in the business sector in Canada that they're all sort of rushing to say raise taxes to build new social housing, because they're not. But what's really interesting, you know, our federal parliament is called the House of Commons, and there's a committee of the House of Commons that goes around the country in the fall to ask Canadians what their views are as they prepare for the next federal budget. It's called the pre-budget consultation process, and I was making my annual appearance before the committee, I guess October, November, I don't remember exactly when, and happened to be stuck right before a representative from the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, which of course is a big business lobby group. And the Canadian Chamber of Commerce person was talking about, you know, we got to cut taxes, we got to cut spending, we got to get the fundamentals in shape, the usual line that you hear from the business sector. And the members of the committee said, wait a minute, you've just heard how serious the homeless problem is and the housing problem is. How can you stand here and tell us that we should be cutting more when we just heard that we have to be spending more? And it was quite interesting. It was a bit of an about-face, and the business person said, well, of course, we're not saying to cut essential programs like health, education, or homeless programs. We're saying cut the frills. And so, you know, you try and make a bit of progress. You try and try and move ahead. And, you know, in the meantime, our very, very big strategic challenge in this country is that Canada is kind of uneasily situated in some ways halfway between the United States and Europe. You know, we have politicians who in their rhetoric and in their public face, they want to pretend like they're European politicians and have a big social conscience and do good things, but in terms of their actual practice, they're much more like George Bush. And they want to cut and give tax breaks to their wealthy friends. So what we the real challenge for us is to connect those two things together. And in fact, our new prime minister, we just had a new prime minister who came into office in December, a big corporate type named Paul Martin, who's getting quite a rough ride. But he's a classic example of this kind of typical Canadian politician. Back in 1990, he headed up a task force on behalf of his political party on housing. He called for massive reinvestment of government spending in national housing programs, 3 years later, his party gets elected. He becomes the finance minister, which is the second most important position in the federal government after the prime minister. And he proceeds to break every promise that he made.
We have that in America, too.
I know, unfortunately, it's a disease of...
Just joining us, I want them to know that they are listening to the combined American and Canadian homelessness marathons. We're having a special once-a-year discussion of homelessness and poverty tonight. Walter, what kind of a tax burden does the average... what kind of a tax burden do you have in Switzerland? Are you facing a tax revolt in Switzerland to pay for all the housing for poor people and stuff?
Well, I think the taxes are also a big issue here, and it's clear that that parts of the political spectrum wants to lower the taxes and others want to keep them. And we have, you know, in Switzerland we have a direct democracy, which means that very often people are called to vote on these issues. And we will have, for instance, a vote in next May, which is the question whether we would raise up the consumer tax for 1%, yes or no, in order to finance the social security system. So you can imagine that this leads to a lot of discussion in the country whether we should pay this or to agree to this increase of taxes or not. And then there are other taxes like the inheritance taxes, which have been fought in referendums over the last years, and the population has abolished these taxes. So there's also back and forth of politically on this issue. The tax burden generally in Switzerland is I would say, a little bit lower than average in Europe. So it is, for me, for instance, about, well, because I have a quite an okay salary, so about a fourth of my salary is taxed. But there are other people who have much less to pay, that's sure.
That's not so much.
That's not so much, yeah.
Not by our standards. I mean,
That's
not...
And I would like to say for the citizen, it's very important to know what he gets back from these taxes. And for instance, to me, it's very important that, for instance, the education system is quite good. So I have two children who go to school, and I have not to pay for school. So I feel that my taxes are quite okay invested. If you don't get anything back from the state, then you would say, why pay taxes?
So, Walter, do you ever have, in the political debate in Switzerland... I'm just curious. I have no interest.
And what kind of debate?
In your political debate in Switzerland,
yes.
Do people ever say, let's not wind up like the United States? Are we considered a good example or a bad example over there in terms of our social policies?
Well, I mean, you know, every country tends to see its own problem as it's very special. You know? So everybody thinks that the social problems can be solved by this and this measure, and they never look at other countries and never look at other experiences to see how much we share things. And I think there are many, many things in combating poverty or also ensuring social security which are very similar over the in the different countries. For instance, the fact of the demographic change, which is a fact which has impact, or the question of the mobility of business who can move out of the country much easier actually, for instance, in a small country like Switzerland, where the companies all along can say, well, we just move somewhere else to produce if the conditions are not okay anymore. In a big country like Canada or U.S., the economy remains a little bit more, I would say, solid to the territory. But in our countries, business is moving back and forth, and so this kind of competition is the sense of competition is very strong, and this means that social policy has always to be some kind of a mixture between measures you can implement and then also see how you can finance it. And this means that in a way we share many problems with like other countries, but there are specific things, as I said, for instance, the direct democracy in Switzerland, which leads to much more debate on the facts, not just on persons you could elect or not elect, because you can say yes or no to bills, you can yes or no to constitutional changes, and you are called to vote every 3 months. So every 3 months there is a debate about big things, and that makes it very lively.
What about in Canada? You think America is a good example or a bad example there, up there?
No offense to any of the lovely people who are listening to this program, but by and large, we have been the recipients of lots of bad made in USA policies. And, whether you look at, 1973, our national government brought in an amazing national housing program. I mentioned it earlier, about 600,000 units of housing, very successful, cost-effective housing. I, in fact, live in a housing co-op that was built under that program, and that was all junked in 1993 in favor of what people were going to call a U.S.-style system where we rely more on the private sector and rely on various subsidies and grants and that sort of thing. And, you know, in fact, of course, the private sector, either in the United States or nor in Canada, has been able to provide affordable housing for low, moderate-income households, and so the housing crisis keeps getting worse and worse. Certainly, our politicians at both the national level and in most provinces, there's been a race to try and cut taxes below the tax levels in the United States based on this very same argument that Walter mentioned, and that is that if we don't do that, then businesses will leave our country and they'll go to the United States or even go to Mexico or somewhere like that. So there's been this kind of race to the bottom that's happened in recent years in terms of trying to cut taxes, but also in terms of social programs. The argument has been we can't afford, Canada's quite proud of the fact that most Canadians are proud of the fact that we have a national health care system, which, flawed as it is, in fact does provide reasonably good health care for all citizens, and we don't have large numbers of people who are without health care in this country. Good system, but many people are trying to dismantle that system, to privatize bits and pieces of it, to move more to a U.S.-style model. So most of us are very worried about this rift, and in fact, we're especially worried. Our new prime minister, his name is Paul Martin. He has been anxious. He said very clearly that one of his major agendas is to make friends with the Bush administration. And so one of the things that he wants to do, for instance, embrace the missile defense shield that is the big mania among certain people in the Bush administration, and wants to engage in a number of other policies. And as you know, Canada last year decided we were going to sit out the invasion of Iraq. We said it's not our war, and it's an illegal war. It's an illegal invasion, and we're not going to take part in it. And that was a different prime minister. Our prime minister now, I think, faced with the same question, would say, George, if you want us to do it, just tell us where you want us to go, and we'll do it. So it's worrisome that we have now a federal government that seems to put pleasing the Bush administration at the top of its political agenda.
Well, that's an interesting point you raise. Walter, do you think, I know that one of the reasons we don't see what happens to our tax dollars here, you were talking about people have to see their tax dollars coming back. Well, one of the reasons we don't see them is that they're going into armaments, whatever anybody may think of that, but we don't get any practical benefit out of those armaments. If you want to make the case that they are protecting our country, fine, but on a day-to-day basis, we don't see it the way you see a school and experience it. What kind of an expenditure on defense does Switzerland have? Is it less than ours? Is that what makes it possible?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's much, much less compared to, I think, it comes after Social Security, it comes after education. There are other budget items which are much more important than the military. So it has been cut back over in the last years substantially. So it doesn't make that much of the budget anymore. I think it's now probably around 10% or less. So it's definitely much less than the United States. Let me say a word, because what the colleague from Toronto said about the American model for social policy, I think they have a strong impact here too. And this is really somehow frightening, because as was said with the health care system, for instance, I think Europe has an idea that health care is something which is the task of the public and not just the private market. And in this sense, health care for the whole population guaranteed in most European countries, especially here in Switzerland. Also, the homeless people, everybody is insured against illness. So the health care system is definitely better. But on the politically, we have also strong pressure now to liberalize or to privatize the whole health sector, which will have a huge impact on Europe if that succeeds. And I think it is really bad that we have not an open discussion about the advantages and disadvantages of the different models. And I think, for instance, with regard to the healthcare system, well, every system has problems, but it's by and large, it's a much better one because it protects the whole population in a similar way. And this is also true for many other social solutions which have been developed in Europe over the last 100 years or so, which are, well, they have their weaknesses, but they are not simply bad. And in a talk we have, in a political talk, somehow the impression gets spread that the old solutions in Europe, they are old, they are not working, they are not competitive, and that the American ones are the much better ones. And when you're going to look down in the streets, in the reality of the people, you see that that there is also a lot of high price to pay if you change the model. And I only hope that we will be able, in a constructive dialogue over these models, to take the advantages of the different systems, just in order just to say that's the better one, that's our one, that's the supremacy of one system. And I think this is true a little bit for the whole politics today. So I think there's a little bit of fight over models instead of developing new models and learning from each other.
Michael, what do you think about that?
Well, I absolutely agree. I was just thinking in terms of the military that we have. We're getting a lot of pressure from south of the border, from the United States, to increase our military spending. Canada, in relative terms, I guess I could do it off the top of my head, but it probably spends just a couple of percentage points of its overall national budget on the military. We don't put a lot of money into the military, and many people say, you know, that's the way it should be, that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we were told there was a Cold War, we had to spend lots of money to protect us from communist peril and all that sort of stuff, but Cold War is supposed to be over, and there was supposed to be a peace dividend, and part of that peace dividend was to stop spending money in the military and start spending it on the social needs of people, and that was supposed to be the quid pro quo, and for a while in Canada that actually happened, that there was a steady decrease in military spending and a steady increase in social spending, but that all, you know, in the 1980s, but really with a vengeance in the 1990s, it all reversed itself when our national government decided, you know, again, looking south of the border and saying we've got to be competitive with the United States in terms of spending, in terms of taxation, so we've got to cut these sorts of things, and we'll just let the private market deal with everything. And you know, I mentioned earlier on about this exercise I had with a big national bank in Canada called the Toronto Dominion Bank, and one of the most interesting things in their housing study that they came out with, and it was, you know, for a bank, it was a radical admission for them to make, but in the middle of their study, they have a little section where they said, you know, there's been 10 years of economic expansion in Canada, and, you know, from the end of the last recession in the 1993 to the present, and all the general economic indicators have been good. The aggregates have all been good. But despite that, there's been more poverty, more homelessness, and more social distress in this country. And so the bank said, well, clearly the old formula of a rising tide lifts all boats doesn't in fact work. You know, clearly the old economic argument is not...
What if you don't have a boat? That's what I always want.
Well, that's exactly the point. Now,
we're going to actually have to say goodbye now. Michael, thank you for your
think tanks in Canada all condemned the bank and said, "Oh, you know, it's bad research. You know, it's not very good science and all that kind of stuff." Because they were really upset that, you know, here was a bank saying something that.
We're actually going to have to say goodbye. Michael Shapcott, co-chair of the National Housing and Homelessness Network, Walter Schmid, president of the Swiss Social Welfare Conference, and Nobody, the coordinator of the U.S. Marathon. We'd like to thank you for the time you've spent with us in the last hour taking a global look at homelessness. We here in Montreal, in front of the Café Sur la Rue, are moving on. In the next hour, we are going to be looking at growing populations on the street, but we want to thank the people who took the time to share with us an international perspective on homelessness. Also, I'd like to apologize to the callers who tried to get on and couldn't in the last hour, and we encourage you to try once again to reach us. Our toll-free number is 1-866 763-4136, 1-866-763-4136. If you have any questions, comments, any feelings or ideas that you would like to share about youth on the street, women or people in precarious situations on the street, here in Montreal we have 5,000 youth, and I can tell you it is cold tonight, and I do not wish anybody to have to spend tonight on the street. We are going to be with you until 7 a.m., and we'll be taking your calls on any subject that we're speaking about. In the next hour, we're going to be talking with a youth counselor from the second largest street service organization in Canada. That's an organization called Dans la Rue. We'll also be talking to some people from Toronto, the Native Men's Residence Youth Center, called Tumavit. We've already spoken to some people from that in previous hours on this broadcast. You're listening to the Homelessness Marathon live on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Also live on 30 stations across Canada, community and alternative stations, including CFIE 106.5 FM, that's Aboriginal Voices Radio in Toronto, CFBU 103.7 FM, St. Catharines, CKLN 88.1 FM, our sister station in Toronto, CFRU Guelph, CFRC Radio Queens, and many, many more. Anybody listening to any of those stations across the country, we would love to hear from you. 1-866-763-4136. I'd like to apologize for the abrupt departure to Michael Shapcott from the Disaster Relief Committee of the National Housing and Homelessness Network in Toronto. Wonderful to hear his perspective, sharing his perspective on the global problem of homelessness and specifically a Canadian perspective. Also Walter Schmidt from the Swiss Social Welfare Conference. Right now we're going to listen to some thoughts on itinérance. We want to mention and thank the workers of Le Journal d'Itinéraire. We are outside their doorstep. They publish from the offices right behind the Café Sur la Rue, and a lot of the people working on that journal are working also on our project. And what l'itinérance means is being without shelter, sans abri. It means being left to your own devices, left without social support, left without everything that is guaranteed to us by our declarations nationally and internationally, and despite the fine words, as Michael Shapcott pointed out, by our government and international representatives about the right to housing and the urgency of the issue, people are left itinerant on the streets. You're listening to a broadcast from the streets, the Montreal-based Homelessness Marathon, coming to you from CKUT 90.3 FM, 30 other stations involved, and now a short piece called Itinérance before we come back with a look at youth on the streets.
Oui, bonjour, ici André Larose de la station CKIA 88,3 FM à Québec, de l'émission Tout simplement l'Aube. Nous sommes en ondes pour le marathon des sans-abri qui se déroule à Grand-Val du Canada et je suis accompagné de Monsieur Frédéric Lapointe de la maison L'Aube-Rivière à Québec qui va nous parler un petit peu d'itinérance. Bonjour Monsieur Lapointe.
Bonjour André.
C'est quoi l'itinérance à Québec?
Ben l'itinérance à Québec, il n'y a pas vraiment de portrait type d'itinérance à Québec. L'itinérance, malheureusement, est en croissance assez majeure. De plus en plus, on peut retrouver des jeunes, des familles, des femmes qui fréquentent les centres d'hébergement pour les personnes, pour les sans-abri. C'est un peu dû, je pourrais dire, à l'augmentation des coûts de loyer qui okay. est effectué par les propriétaires.
Ben c'est ça qui était ma question. Qu'est-ce qui amène les gens à Québec à être, on va dire, de vivre de l'itinérance?
Il y a plusieurs facteurs. Comme je te disais, il y a l'augmentation des coûts de loyer qui donne un peu une chance aux propriétaires, une chance pour eux, de gonfler les prix sans crainte de ne pas trouver preneur. T'as beaucoup aussi maintenant, la réalité fait que les sorties de prison, les sorties de pénitenciers, les sorties d'hôpitaux, la désinstitutionnalisation aussi, qui fait que les gens fréquentent énormément les centres d'hébergement. Ici, okay. à la région de Québec, les centres d'hébergement affichent toujours complets.
OK. Tantôt, on parlait ensemble, puis tu me disais que la clientèle itinérante rajeunit beaucoup. Ça, c'est plus jeune à Québec, la clientèle. Hein?
Ah, énormément. Ça l'a changé. Écoute, maintenant, on peut... ce qu'on voit dans les centres d'hébergement, à Québec, c'est qu'on peut croiser un jeune d'à peine 18 ans qui est avec un